This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. I'm doing well. All is well.
Dr. Hawk, welcome back. How are you doing, Dr. Hawk?
Gone for a whole week, and I get a heroine's welcome, I see. So.
it sounds like you've been busy in the last couple of weeks.
Been a little busy. There's a lot going on.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well,
yeah, go ahead, Nathan.
Oh, I was just going to go on to questions, but Dr. Ladd, did you want to say anything different?
I just had a stray question that I just remembered. A client wanted to know whether Jen utilized 10 paid dates.
A lady never tells.
No, of course. Of course. But I had to throw it out there just for my client. That's all right.
I largely followed my own advice.
Yes, good. Glad to hear it. All right. All right. Go ahead, Nathan.
All right.
What's up?
Well, we've got a really couple of deep questions that we're looking forward to, and got a question that Dr. Hawk will take the stage on, and then another question here. So we've got three or four questions. We'll try to get through them.
Okay.
And we're looking forward to it. So we'll start off.
Grand.
Dear doctors.
Yeah.
I've been reading Robert Plomin's book Blueprint, and have come to some confusion reconciling the selfish gene's central ideas and Plomin's description of genetics. I admittedly have an educational background in finance and only got into biology from listening to this show, so perhaps I'm just missing something. The confusion, though, comes from trying to understand how the notion of self-selected pressures at the individual gene level would be possible when so many traits of the phenotype are the result of the interaction of several genes within the genome. How can individual genes, quote, compete when each individual gene is reliant on how it correlates with the rest of the genome? I did some quick research poking around trying to understand this cognitive mismatch in my own educational understanding and came across some researchers suggesting that there is now a contemporary group selection idea in evolutionary biology that in some ways discredits Dawkins' ideas. I definitely feel well out of my league trying to even put together a coherent question on this topic. And again, maybe I'm just misunderstanding both the selfish gene and could be well served to read it again, and am biting off more than I can chew with Blueprint. Regardless, I think this would be an interesting discussion on the podcast to really get into the weeds of the mechanics of evolutionary biology.
Oh, well, group selection is one of Doug's favorite topics, so I think he should he should go to town on this one.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit too much, too many different ideas that the person's trying to. They're definitely got some confusion in what they're trying to figure out. So let's begin with where it is that they are starting, which is the confusion about how a single gene can go about competing for its own interest inside the organism when it has to work in concert with so many other genes, and. So how would that work? And the way it works, if you don't think of it as competition, it's not like, I mean, Dawkins does a once in a lifetime job of transforming the language of genetics down into a way that we think of these things as if they're conscious entities with intentions. Okay, so the selfish gene was a was a revolution in thinking about biology by turning around the way we typically thought about biology before Dawkins and now how we think about biology post the selfish gene. So the notion, the gene isn't selfish. What it does is it's a little program to program proteins to be made that will cause that organism to be more successful. And it's, in other words, that specific gene is out it's actually out to alter the organism in ways that will be useful for that gene to be more likely to be passed on. In general, what that means is the gene that makes that organism better is going to be more likely to survive. That gene is more likely to be passed on. There could be cases where that might not be necessarily true. So you get into tricky areas of biology there, and describing that is going to be beyond this discussion. But to think about how a gene would be would have selection pressure, he uses the word self-selection. That I think he's thinking about, he's a little bit lost there, but that's okay. Think about a painting. Or maybe we should think about a very complicated machine, super complicated machine that, I don't know, makes some kind of widget. And think about putting a different part in that machine that where the materials are slightly different, and now that machine is less likely to fail. So the whole machine is necessary to make widgets, but every little part of that machine is part of the machine. And every little part of that machine could be improved. And so the way evolution works is it works by changing one gene at a time. So you might think, well, how does that go about? How does this happen? Well, think about the concept of, let's suppose you've got a car, you've got a, I don't know, a 57 Ford, I don't know, Edsel, and they didn't make that till maybe 59, but whatever. So it's got some part in there, and there's like 10 different ways, slightly different ways you could build the part that would be common. So maybe you'll make it out of aluminum, this one you make out of steel, this one you make it out of steel, but you put little rubber gaskets on the end. In other words, slight alterations. Now, all of them will work, but one of them will work a little bit better than the other ones. So this is how evolution works. And in fact, it works with, of those 10, then somebody comes up with an idea and alters something that you wouldn't actually have thought of or wouldn't even necessarily have made sense, but it, you know, we dip one end in a touch of titanium, liquid titanium, and suddenly it works quite a bit better. That's exactly how evolution works. So evolution works by having a little mutation change an existing gene, and that changes the outcome of what that gene makes or what it creates and alters it a little bit. And now suddenly it turns out that there's a tiny advantage to the organism because that gene is better than its rival alleles. Okay, so evolution moves towards the genes that are building the organism are wind up being a selected, you know, they're randomly generated by mutation. And then they get selected gene by gene to change the machine's characteristics so that it's a better and better and better and better fit for the ecological constraints or the ecological pressures that it has on it. So don't think of, there's not like one gene for height in people. There's thousands of genes that contribute to your height. You can imagine, though, that in certain habitats, there would be an advantage to being a little bit taller, or there would be an advantage to being a little bit shorter, okay? If you're a little bit shorter and you're a little bit smaller, you can live on a little bit less food, and if you wind up in a situation where there's a major constraint on the food supply, that may be more advantageous. And so that gene, the gene that causes you to be shorter, starts to be more effective in the gene pool, becomes more numerous. And that's how this works. And that happens, for example, where there's usually when ecological disasters or some kind of bizarre situation where an animal gets isolated, very often the smaller animals become selected by evolution. Very often the larger animals are selected by evolution. So there's some size, or we could just take in general the concept of height. There's some height that would be optimal for the organism in its given ecology. We can see, for example, in humans, the ideal height for a given ecology are different in Africa than they are in Southeast Asia. So the people are taller in Africa for whatever reasons, and we don't have any idea what those reasons are. We just know that the genes, thousands of them or hundreds of them at least, that contribute, the gene that makes you a little bit taller, those genes have been more successful in those habitats. So the fact that the genes themselves have to work in concert with other genes to produce complex subsystems in a body, that they, quote, have to cooperate, play friendly with each other, that's not a problem, and that's not group selection. So group selection is, there's, I don't even want to wander into that territory, actually, frankly. So hopefully this is useful to understand. There's no contradiction between anything that Plowman is talking about and anything that Dawkins is talking about. So Plowman, once again, the fact that there may be 1,000 genes that are responsible for, you know, a person's intelligence or a person's body morphology, that doesn't mean that each one of them is having their tiny little influence. They're like little dots on a canvas that's making a painting. And so each of them has a tiny little contribution to the overall thing that you see. And sometimes that dot, if it gets changed, is a little improvement for that habitat. And that's, so evolution takes place at the level of a given gene being selected by the evolution pressures to be more common in the gene pool than some rival gene that isn't quite as good for that habitat. So we start to realize that the goodness and badness of genes a lot of times doesn't make sense unless we are talking about the specific habitat that those genes find themselves. So genes will, sometimes a gene will become more numerous for a while. So maybe people will be taller for a while in a given habitat. And then some ecological changes, and now we start to see that the shorter genes become more common. So it could drift back and forth, sideways, upside down. The gene frequencies can change. It all simply depends upon how well that specific gene, in its infinitesimally small influence on the overall package of the organism, whether it's moving it in a positive direction for that given habitat or a negative direction. And that's how that works. If you want an exceptional education in the nature of natural selection and how genes work in principle, the best thing I've ever read is The Blind Watchmaker by Dawkins. So just to put in a little plug for Dawkins' writings, I haven't read much since I read the canon of Richard Dawkins, which is The Selfish Gene, The Extended Phenotype, and then The Blind Watchmaker. After that, I read The God Delusion. I only read half of it, and then I'd seen enough. I tried to read The Ancestor's Tale, but it's just more Dawkins, you know, grinding and drivel. The truth of the matter is those three are the main conceptual. Actually, Climbing Mount Improbable is, again, would be helpful for this questioner. It's sort of an extension and reiteration of The Blind Watchmaker. But I think the concept of incremental changes, each little gene making its influence, and then winding up either being more, causing the organism to be more successful and therefore itself more numerous or not. That is the program of evolution, and that in no way is in any contradiction at all to Plowman's work in behavior genetics.
Wow, Dr. Lau, thank you so much.
Very good.
Dr. Hawk, do you want to tackle any part of this?
No, I don't think there's anything I could possibly add to that. There's always the balance on the podcast with, sort of the whole the whole sort of general gist of the podcast is practical solutions, you know, practical clinical solutions to real life problems. But there is so much interest in this kind of thing. I mean, I get these questions all the time, and I know that Doug does. And so this is just another reminder to folks to come on over to our new website, because we have this new venue to really wind out on this kind of stuff and address these questions as they come up in live Q&As and videos and elsewhere. So we'll keep talking about that. But if you visit esteemdynamics.com, that's we have lots of opportunity to get into the trees and not just the forest.
Well, speaking of practical,
yes.
Our next question. Dear doctors, whenever I don't orgasm during sex, I feel guilty. This may be because I fake the orgasm. I'm not sure whether this is my internal audience censuring me or whether I'm simply empathizing for my guileless husband or maybe something else. Why can't I be honest about my inorgasmia? I don't always have a problem orgasming, but around half the time I fake it. It's not fun. What say you?
This just seems like a question for Jen.
Is this a chick question? We're going to give this to the resident female? Oh, my God.
That's right.
It's all the better for me to somehow get into trouble with this.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my God. Where to begin? So I would want for this specific case to have a much better idea of what's going on sort of in the moment. So I think it's quite common that, you know, we know there's not a physical problem here, that she's saying that she's fine half the time. She's able to orgasm, whether on her own or with her partner. So this is not a physical problem that she's having. This is a cost benefit analysis problem. And so I think it's very, very common that women are, most women are not easily orgasmic all the time. Some are, but most are not. Some are very rarely orgasmic, if at all. So she's, you know, right in the middle of the bell curve. And the thing is like, again, I kind of want to know what's going on. There's a point in every sexual encounter where you realize it's not going to happen and you abandon the attempt and decide to fake it. So what's going on in that moment? Are you sort of, you know, it's getting late and you want to get to sleep and you're worried about things going on tomorrow? Because there's always this choice point for most women who are in this situation where you could probably get yourself there if you really gave it your full attention and a lot of effort and all hands on deck, so to speak. And you really, really just made it your goal for the night. But you're not making it your goal for the night. You were opting out at some point in the process, and you're deciding that it's better CB wise to fake it. So I think it's probably less of a, like, the guilt you're feeling is essentially you're sending a signal of qualification to your husband that is not entirely genuine, and your internal audience is aware of that, of the false signaling, and, you know, is giving you some guff about it. But I think it's more likely you're just feeling guilty for the zero-sum redistribution of time and energy that you're taking away from, you know, this well-meaning spouse who thinks that he's done a really good job, and you've tuned out and you've been drafting your grocery list in your mind instead, and given the performance of a lifetime. And so I think it's very, very, very common, but it's going to come down to the actual cost benefit analysis in the moment, in the encounter. I'm not sure what else I could add to that. I'm sure Doug has thoughts though.
Yeah. Just like a guy, my mind was drifting on.
See, when a male's mind, when your mind drifts, it's not a problem. When the female mind drifts, it is a problem. Most females need to be very, very present and engaged.
I would say certainly that there's probably details in these situations that if she's orgasmic half the time, then probably she can be orgasmic 80% of the time. But there's details in this process that may be overlooked. And so that's something to consider And if she doesn't know how to look for that, sometimes there's people that are actually knowledgeable about that that might be helpful to consult with. There's some very knowledgeable people out there in that arena. That's just sort of an aside. It sounds to me like that everything that you have to say, I don't really have too much to add to it, other than the reason why that I'm sort of talking about this is the following, that for some women, it's very difficult and rare to have an orgasm. And and that is usually because there's things that they don't know about their bodies, or it may be because of their relationships, certainly. But a lot of times it's because the nature of the interaction, the whole process is actually lacking in some necessary and sufficient, you know, elements. And sometimes they don't quite know exactly what those elements are. And sometimes other people do know what those elements are. And so just keep that in mind and keep an open mind to the possibility that there may be a little bit to learn about your own sexuality and how to bring better elements into those interactions that may wind up improving that situation.
It's a very engineering way of looking at it.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound to me like there's any technical difficulties here.
All right.
I think it's more of a holistic experience. I think for women, it is very, mm-hmm. very mental. It's very, mm-hmm. it's like, I think most women, if they are not like really present in the moment, and that is winning the cost benefit analysis for where they want to be and where they're putting their time and energy, it's not going to happen for a lot of women. And it's a difficult mm-hmm. trade-off when you've got a lot of things competing for your attention, especially kids, especially, you know, the looming responsibilities of the next day. It's very, very difficult to stay present and devoted to something that just seems like a lot of trouble for not that great a payoff. And so it's like, okay, well, at some point we abandoned ship. And I think you're having a very common experience, but it's not necessarily anything to the conscientiousness is probably driving more guilt than it needs to here.
Undoubtedly. All right.
Your husband's fine.
The
ego trap in there.
I don't even want to think about that.
Would you say there's any ego trap where the expectation from the husband maybe he's sending signals
that
she should be orgasming every time like he is?
Yeah, no, not in that sense, but there can be sort of like, A through Q works in a certain order every time. And so if it's not working this time and she detects that it's not going to work for any number of reasons because she's distracted or she's PMSing or she's tired or whatever it is, mm-hmm. then she...
When she's close, he goes, are you okay?
Yeah, right. so I certainly have been in a situation, and I think most women have been, where it's like, oh God, he's just not going to let this go. better to fake it, because clearly the expectation is so high, and I'm looking at my watch, it's going to be another 2 hours. So this is completely normal. So I wouldn't call that an ego trap, but it is sort of you've become a prisoner of the expectations of the encounter. And particularly if he's approaching it in a very rational, engineering minded sort of way, you could run yourself into a little bit of trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
All right. Moving on.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next question. Thank you. So our next question, dear doctors, what would you recommend for a stay-at-home mom who has two small children and is constrained by time and energy to pursue her individual goals? I am experiencing low mood on a regular basis, and I don't want to turn to medication. Overall, I don't have a strong sense of self-efficacy and feel like my best way forward is simply accepting my situation and letting go of my personal goals for the foreseeable future. My husband and I are not in a financial position to use money as a way to provide childcare or outsource other tasks. I wonder if I'm going through a recalibration process of lowering my goals and expectations, which is the source of my low mood. Am I constrained by time and energy to not feel good until my children are more autonomous?
Well, great question. some complicated engineering and how the mind works here. So let me sort of try to explain what's happening and give you a feel for how I would direct this person. First of all life, the very nature of life itself, is one of competing opportunities. So you could call them competing demands if you want, but what they are is opportunities. And so you've got the possibility of doing X, Y, or Z, and or more things, but maybe X, Y, and Z are the three most prominent, obvious targets out there for changing our circumstances in a way that might be profitable. And so by profitable, we mean it's going to feel good because it's aligned probably with gene survival. So all life is nothing other than the creature examining its environment and trying to analyze competing opportunities. Now, low mood in people signals a confusion that you may not be making the right decision. So it's a sign of some failure feedback. And the failure could come from some effort to achieve something and we're not achieving it. And it could also be a sign of sort of a frustration because you can't solve the problem. And yet, we've got a confusion over competing priorities. So the decision rule that I have is that if you are having... usually there are clues. In other words, the reason you're kind of depressed isn't because you've got, you know, a pain in your ankle. So this person has clear evidence from what goes on inside of her mind and the data that arrives in consciousness that she's aware of what the conflicting demands are. So she's aware that, gee, I'd really like to do some career opportunities. There's some personal goals that I have, and yet my time and energy are being directed at childcare. And it doesn't appear that I've got any other options. I've actually examined the options. I've looked at the constraints on the situation. We look at the time and energy investments that I could make elsewhere, and it just doesn't add up, and therefore I'm stuck until my kids are more autonomous. Now, that's the 10,000-foot view she has of the situation. Now, from my standpoint, I'm very bullheaded about sort of living with these kinds of signals. Because to me, these kinds of signals are saying change, 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 change. They are rattling the system and saying, I believe that there's a better investment of our time and energy that would result in better payoffs. And so my rule is to change something, change a parameter, even a little bit, even temporarily, in order to let the system get more information and therefore see whether or not its suspicion is right. So what we have is the concept that financial constraints are stopping all forward movement, for example, on a career. Now, let's think about that and let's see whether or not that's necessarily true. So maybe this person has some career goals or some ideas, and maybe there needs to be some very small investment, maybe just energy, and learning the stepping stones towards something that she might be interested in doing. So maybe she envisions, for example, I don't know, an online business selling organic oils. I don't know what that stuff is. What is that stuff, Jen? Essential oils.
Like essential oils?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I just made something up.
Not necessarily organic, but yeah, good smelling.
Okay. All right.
Libations, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So let's suppose that that's what she's thinking, but she feels like, oh, well, there's some class and it costs $3,000 to take about how you're supposed to do this, and so therefore I can't do this and we don't have the money, etc. Or maybe she wants to, I don't know, become a paralegal or a lawyer, and yet you can't go to school for that, don't have the money, etc., etc. So my question would be, is there anything that we can do now? Because maybe we're 3 or 4 years away from the kids being more autonomous. Is there some stepping stone that we can hit? Is there anything that we can do? And if there's anything that we can do that could be not very expensive in terms of time and energy that makes you feel like you're starting to make forward progress, then the mood can lift. In fact, it can lift instantly. as soon as we get started at something. So that may or may not work. There may be, for example, another way to stick, maybe you think that you want to be some kind of a counselor, therapist, etc. So maybe you can find some place to volunteer, you know, half a day a week for 4 hours to actually try to stick your foot in the water. Or maybe you want to do childcare for a living and you want to go work one day a week. God forbid, leave your children, have somebody else to take care of them while you take care of other children. I'm just making this up as I go along. The notion is maybe you could do one day a week kind of a job, and in that one day a week, whatever it is that you make, you pay for a babysitter to watch your kids. So there's no financial gain. In fact, there may be a very small financial loss, but it's small. And by the time you do that for 12 weeks, you may find out whether or not, you know, how interested you are in that arena, getting involved in whatever that arena is. So these are all, the notion here is there something that you can do to move you towards what it is that you're dreaming about? You're daydreaming about something. That's what your daydreams are for. They are there to try to guide you and tell you where your nervous system believes that there are untapped opportunities for you to do things that will satisfy your nervous system. That's what they're for. That's exactly what they are. And so they are sort of analogs, living and breathing sort of imaginative analogs for the assembly language subroutines that are taking place wordlessly down in your nervous systems at the level of source code. And so they're bubbling up into your imagination and you're thinking, boy, I'd really like to be doing this one day. Well, see if we can take a 1% step towards there in any fashion. They're almost certainly something that you can do. You know, when people are interested in learning things and possibly pursuing further education, et cetera, I mean, an amazing thing is I believe MIT has made like every course there is in the world available for free online. It's like you don't get credit, you don't get an MIT degree, but you can get the outstanding presentation of the material. So think about how valuable that would be as you pursue your further education if you've already had a whole course in, I don't know, torts. Okay, so so there's always something that you can do to move towards your dreams. If we start to move forward towards it, we may discover some excitement and therefore the abatement of the depression. So if nothing else, it may turn out that the different little forays you make to try to make these small changes, you may discover that you're not that wild about the new domain of interest and that it doesn't feel like it's particularly worth it. However, just in making those explorations, we may find that it quiets down your nervous system in terms of its belief or suspicion that there's a better place to be using your time and energy right now. And so it's kind of like go checking out the house that we think we might be interested in while we're in escrow on the one that we're buying. And then we're kind of upset because there may be something better and we're kind of depressed about the idea of buying the new house. We're not as excited about it. And then we go see the other house and then it turns out there's some problems. There's a noisy neighbor and a weird looking guy with a beard and a shotgun that lives behind there. And it turns out, no, we wouldn't want to live there. We're much more comfortable in the house that we're in. So this is how it is that we go about things, is that we take seriously disturbances in mood that are persistent, and that's a part of her question was that it's persistent and relatively longstanding. This tells me there's an unconscious and conscious, but certainly an unconscious process that is saying, I don't think we're using our time and energy optimally. I don't think we're using our time and energy optimally. In the context of, you know, my husband and our finances and the kids, this looks to be the best solution, and nobody can tell me an obvious one better, but I still not believe in it. Okay? So now the next move is, listen, you don't have to make a huge decision. Decision rule is never make a big decision when a small decision will do. Make a small decision moving towards your dream. Find out what that does to your mood. It may do nothing other than give you peace of mind about where it is that you are now, and make the next few years essentially less disturbing and frustrating. The this is part of the way these systems works is part of a bigger argument that I call how to solve a problem. And it's part of a detailed systematic approach I use to approach problems, as including orgasmic problems.
May have its limitations in terms of its application.
Jen was sort of tapping me on the shoulder in the last week to make a presentation for our members, part of our website, and I did that, but I wasn't smart enough to get the technology right because it's the first time I tried to do this. So I'm going to be doing that this week, and there will be a more detailed explanation of this way that we go about looking at the system of where it is that we begin, or the architecture of how we solve any problem. Remember that a problem is just an obstacle between you and a goal. That's all it is. And so if we look at it that way, there's a generic approach to all problem solving, and that what we then do here is we try to use essentially the generic program that I have in my head explicitly and Jen has implicitly and more artistically. But it's the same notion about how it is that we remove obstacles between us and our goals in a process that is is meant to be pretty intolerant of human suffering. So anyway, this is the cliff notes here, which is that feelings are signals. We take them seriously. We change some parameter by trying to make at least a small decision that alters our situation. And we will, in fact, learn something. We will, if nothing else, we will improve in a sense of satisfaction that we're better utilizing our opportunities. So that's how, with more information, we're going to be able to make better decisions. So that's how we do it.
Thank you, Dr. Lyle. And by the way, for the listeners who haven't heard, the esteemdynamics.com is where you can become a member and listen to the brand new library of information that Dr. Hawk and Dr. Lyle have released.
All good. All right.
All right. So our final question, dear doctors, why do so many of us seek entertainment over sleep, even though we're very tired? How could our minds possibly be so convinced that this is a worthwhile thing?
Well, this seems very similar to the orgasm question, actually. It's essentially the same question in a different clothing. So it's kind of the theme of the show today is the cost-benefit analysis. So you're choosing entertainment over sleep for the same reason you're choosing to fake an orgasm over the time and energy that it could has in previous experience gotten you there, and that could in principle get you there again. Seems like that would be the more evolutionarily sound use of your time, but that's not the conclusion that your nervous system is coming to. And in this case, I mean, most people, when they're seeking entertainment, so if you're sitting there and you're watching YouTube videos, or you're binge watching something on Netflix, and you're putting off sleep, even when you know you have a busy day tomorrow, and it's you're sleep deprived, it's tapping into this. Notion that your nervous system is letting you know that there's something to be gained from the information of what you're watching or what you're reading or whatever you're using to entertain yourself. It's essentially masquerading as important information in the Stone Age. And we've talked before in very recent episodes and elsewhere about how incredibly important and what an incredible advantage it is to know something about about village life, about how to do things better than you've been doing them already. Any kind of informational advantage that you can bring gets you personally more status in the village and has all of this potential gain behind it if you can bring this information back to people who don't have it. And so even something as, time draining and fundamentally useless as a mindless show on Netflix or a video game or anything like that, is is tapping into that desire, and that those little circuits are getting all lit up. And then there are other things going on too. So if you're spending all that time on social media, if that's how you're entertaining yourself, we don't know from the question what your drug of choice is, but social media is bringing with it all of the pseudo-esteem, which is hijacking all of your esteem detection mechanisms. And so you're posting things, looking for likes, looking for retweets, looking for more followers, whatever it is that is, you know, letting you believe that you're accumulating status in the village. All of these things are much more important from a survival and reproduction point of view than just getting an extra hour of sleep, because there's just so much greater advantage potentially to be gained by them. So you're somehow hijacking the process. You're coming to the conclusion over and over again that, yeah, sleep would be great in principle, but it's a form of a pleasure trap, essentially. Why are you choosing crappy food over healthy food? You know that it's the better thing to do to eat the kale, and you're going for the Twinkie. So you shouldn't be doing it, and yet you are. You have taken ancient decision-making rules and situated them in a modern environment with endless entertainment available on demand all night long with artificial light and electricity and everything else. And you're really, really constrained by that whole situation. So you have to white-knuckle your way out of that habit, just like you have to white knuckle out of it with any kind of other pleasure hijacking process, pleasure trap or not. But we'd want to know more about exactly how you're spending that time to give you more specifics. But that should be able to get you started.
Perfect. Couldn't. I don't think there's a single thought I had that you didn't say better than was in my head.
Aw. That's high praise from the engineer. Did I even say them in the right order?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It didn't have that beautiful linear feel.
Well, just throwing spaghetti at the wall over here. That's how we operate with our lady brains.
That's right. All good. Fabulous.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.